Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really glad to be spending most of this hour with three talented people who are involved in an exciting theatrical undertaking here in Kenosha at the Lakeside Players home in the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha. They are mounting the musical The Secret Garden, and it will be opening tonight and running for the next three weekends. I'm sure many of you at least have some acquaintance with this beautiful story based on a novel from the early 20th century, transformed into a highly engrossing classic film a few years ago, and then in the early 1990s transformed into a very, very successful and beautiful musical. With us today in the room, in the studio, is Katie Gray, who is the stage director of this production, and two of the members of her cast are with us as well. We have Joe Cardamone, who is joining us, who is portraying the role of Archibald Craven, and Evelyn, pronounce your last name.
Alambreros.
I just realized I know I say your mom's name, Amy Bowdersey, all the time, but I don't say, I know, and I certainly know your dad, but I don't pronounce his last name very often. But anyway, Evelyn, who I know very well from several previous productions, is in the very crucial role of young Mary. And so it's exciting to have all three of you here in the studios. We welcome you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. I'm not sure which of you is better equipped to answer this question, but I suspect Katie or Joe, one of you can kind of tell the story of how this ends up on the Lakeside Players schedule. Any background on how this got chosen to be the musical for this season?
Our former president, Oliver Johnson, is a very big fan of the musical, and so he pushed for it hard the last couple years, and so we were finally able to put it on this year. So it's very exciting because it's such a beautiful musical, and I know he was really passionate about it.
Right. So somebody should sketch the story for us, just kind of the basic outline of it. Such a beautiful story at its heart.
It is about Mary Lennox, an orphaned English girl who actually grew up in India, who comes to live with her uncle Archibald, who is still mourning the death of his wife. And they have a son who is ill. And it's about really the kid's journey into kind of discovering how to be happy. And it's about Archibald's journey into really finishing grieving the death of his wife. And it's, like I said, it's a beautiful story, and it's just, it's different than the movie. It's definitely more focused on the adults of the movie, of the show, but it's just, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely focuses on Mary and kind of how she helps Archibald heal.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those cases in which we have this story that was a novel in 1911, highly acclaimed, and of course transformed into a film. I don't forget if that was the late 1940s maybe, but a film that some people have seen, and now a musical. Now you as the director, are you interested in your cast watching that movie or reading this novel or coming at it with any of that kind of background, or are you a director who prefers, in a sense, a fresh start?
I'm kind of both. I think a lot of people have read the book. I read the book in school, and I know that just from speaking from some of the cast, they've also read it. I think that because the movie is so different than the musical, I don't like watching anything of a role I'm about to do because I don't want that to influence how I'm going to do it. So, but I'm sure that people have seen the movie.
Have you seen the film?
I actually have not. My experience with it was, I knew of the book, but it's actually funny. I was trying to remember how I first became aware of the musical. I thought I'd seen it when I was in high school, and then I discovered it debuted in Broadway when I was in college, so obviously I didn't. Mm. So it may have been that my parents had seen it and sent me the CD or something like that, but I fell in love with the music. I got a copy of the script to the show. I fell in love with the script of the show. And that was more than 20 years ago. I finally read the book late last year after I got cast, because I thought I should probably at least go over the source material once. And it was interesting to see how it differs subtly from the script, which again is what I've known for two decades.
Right. How about you, Evelyn? What was your acquaintance with The Secret Garden ahead of all of this?
I vaguely recall seeing the movie when I was younger, but I didn't really remember the story. Once I got cast in Secret Garden, I did read the book, and it was really cool. Some of the lines that they would say was also in the script, so I would be kind of like, oh, this is what they say next. But it was very cool to kind of get the inside story of the story, almost.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more that's in the novel that can't possibly be on the stage. You have more of a sense of the background and so on. Evelyn, let's stay with you for a moment and find out the sort of the seminal event that set so much of this emotion, namely a tragic cholera event epidemic that essentially orphans you. Tell us what you know about that and what we see of that or hear of that in the musical.
In the very beginning, you see, like, there's a party and you can see the cholera being passed around. And at the end, they do all die. And Mary wakes up and there's no one left. So
her whole family, you mean, is perishes?
Yeah, all the servants as well. So she's pretty much isolated there. With never knowing her uncle and just kind of going there without knowing really what's going on, almost. I mean, she knows that there was the cholera and what had happened to her parents, but she doesn't really quite remember them. So she has to kind of go through the journey of, like, remembering because of the emotional journey that she's been through. As well as making her way through this new life.
Wow. So it's kind of a double-decker grief story. Mm-hmm. Mary has lost essentially all of her family, and she is sent to live with then what would be...
the saddest man in England.
Right. You're right. So explain to our listeners, Joe, a little bit about what cloaks Archibald Craven's life in such... sorrow.
He's described early on as a hunchback who, despite all of his money I presume power, sort of a gloomy fellow, kind of shuts himself up in his house until he meets his wife, who's Mary's aunt, and it's at least implied that brings him a lot of happiness, and they have a child together, and tragically, the wife dies in childbirth, the line from the show is, it made him worse than ever. Mm. And the sense is he spends very little time at home. He spends most of his time traveling, really running, I think, from memories, and trying to put as much distance as he can between himself and the sight of all of this sort of, in his mind, tragedy. The double tragedy being that in doing that, he's also very intentionally... creating a barrier between himself and his son, and some of that is dictated by the medical advice he's being given, but nonetheless, so he doesn't even have that to sort of fall back on, so he's incredibly isolated, incredibly alone, and as you say, it's his story as well as how do you break through that type of incredible grief,
right. And, of course, what's really striking then as you describe the story like this is how in the world do these two find their way out of that? Because in some ways it seems like the unlikeliest of scenarios that a grief-stricken little girl and a grief-stricken older man are somehow going to find their way out of their grief. I mean, a more typical story would be that that one is the bright light that pulls the other out of the darkness, but they both begin in such dark places. So how does that miracle occur? I mean, what's the key to that?
I think it's definitely just Mary bringing in a sort of light to the house that hasn't been there since Lily, Archibald's wife's passing. And I think that it also helps that she's made friends with his son and kind of pulls him out of his shell, because he thinks he's been abandoned by his father because he's never there. So he thinks, of course, that his father hates him because his mother died. So I think that even though she's grieving, she's, you know, still young. And I think she realizes that she kind of has to make the best of things in order to survive in the house. And it kind of pulls him out of that as well.
Yeah, I guess, and I'd say along those lines, I think whereas Archie has very much retreated inward, Mary takes the opportunity to sort of expand her world. And it's not really mentioned much in the musical, but certainly in the novel, it's made very clear that she's a isolated, kind of selfish, you know, privileged child who really never interacts with anybody else other than the servants. She has a distant mother, a father who's in the military, and so probably doesn't have to have a lot of time for domestic duties. And so instead of retreating in, she very much comes out of her shell and by making friends for the first time in her life and exploring and trying new things. And
So, Evelyn, tell us what it's like to be given an opportunity to portray a character like this who has experienced a life so different from your own. Just talk about the experience of having to try to bring alive and make authentic on the stage experiences of a very different person who has experienced a very, very different life than yours.
As an actor, it's wonderful to show the character's development and how they change in a way. So I've been having a lot of fun reading in more into the character and figuring out especially what Mary would have thought pretty much through each line. Like, what would she have been thinking? Would she have been thinking of her past life? Would she have been thinking of the present or maybe even the future? So kind of just thinking about how she was raised, because she was definitely raised very differently than I was. She's very bratty, which is also kind of fun to portray.
And then how about you, Joe? Because as we've described this character of Archibald Craven, that doesn't sound like the Joe Cardamone and I know. What's sort of the fun and the challenge of having to put yourself sort of in the shoes of somebody who I'm happy to say has experienced a life very different from the one that that you have?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a challenge. And I guess probably echoing Evelyn, you know, it's fun as an actor. I find that with only a couple of exceptions, you know, I feel like I've been you know, you play two type, and people, you know, start to see you in a certain light, and you get certain roles. Not to complain, and not to say that, you know, I think every role you do, you know, you find those reflections of yourself in them. Like I said, it's interesting because I became familiar with it when I was in college, and in fact, the senior the spring musical at my college is always student driven. It's picked by a committee of students. It's directed by students. It's, you know, staffed by students, etc. And my senior year, the Secret Garden was one of the possible options. Was one of the proposals, and perhaps because it was still only a couple years old, and I think it only closed on Broadway maybe the year before. Or even earlier that year, I don't know. They never got a straight answer as to whether or not the rights were available. I mean, or, you know, so the committee understandably didn't want to take a chance on getting halfway through it and discovering they couldn't do it. So they went with the other proposal. But so I've told people I've literally been waiting 20 years to do this. I did Archibald's two solos as part of my senior recital. And but in much the same way, I've been blessed in that I've been able to revisit a couple of roles with the benefit of a lot of time. I did the lead in Brigadoon in high school, and again, almost 20 years later. I was the baker in Into the Woods in college, and then came back to direct it nearly 20 years later. And there's definitely a part of my brain that's saying, you know, could I have played Archie as a 21 or 22 year old? Absolutely. Do I think that I have a much greater understanding of at least what that might be like now as a husband and father? Absolutely. You know, and there's something of a benefit, I think, to the delay
right.
in getting to finally get a shot at the part.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking about The Secret Garden, which is opening tonight at the Rodie Opera House in downtown Kenosha, presented by the Lakeside Players. This is the first of 3 weekends of performances. I'm really happy to say that Joe thought to bring the compact disc of the show along, and I think we'll give at least a couple of you a chance to request a favorite moment to be played, and we can at least hear a portion of it. And Evelyn, let's start with you. Is there a moment from the show that you think would be kind of an enticing thing to share with our listeners?
I guess I love the moment if I heard someone crying, because it's her first night there, and she hears someone crying. And Archie and Lily do make an appearance in that one, too. So.
Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit of this moment. So this is from Act One. Mm-hmm. So this is not long after the character of Mary has been shipped away from where she was living in India, shipped to, is it Yorkshire, England?
It's in Yorkshire, yeah.
Yorkshire, England, to be... living in this strange, scary old house with this strange, scary old uncle whom she has never known before.
Who won't even see her the night she arrives.
Wow. Yeah. So here's a little bit of I Heard Someone Crying from The Secret Garden. A little portion of this moment from Act One, I Heard Someone Crying from The Secret Garden. It occurs to me, this is probably a question mostly for you, Katie, that in some ways grief is can be a powerful draw for an audience, but there's also something about grief that we can really grow weary of it after a while. That is, I should think that's... It's a challenge maybe for you as the director to sort of figure out how thick should this sorrow be, and at what point do the clouds begin to lift, and how do we make that feel authentic?
Yeah, and I think that it is something to be said for the writers of the musical, that it is really interspersed with some happier songs of when Mary meets her first friends in the house, and her, which are also some of the servants, but it's a very different, obviously, life than she lived in India. And I think that it's not all just these really sad songs and then it's the end. It's, you know, a lot of her hopefulness for finding the garden, the secret garden, and just learning more about what she can do and what she can accomplish. And it's definitely her coming out of her grief definitely in the second act, it's more of her coming out of her grief, and Archie to an extent a lot later in the act, it's his coming out of his grief.
He's so, slower to come.
Yeah. Absolutely,
well, kids are more resilient.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so true. It is. It's very good that it's not just these sad song after sad song. It's, you know, these fun little happy tunes where she's meeting friends for the first time. So I think that, like I said, it's a credit to the writers of the musical.
Right. Otherwise, it could like be that. Quite a slog.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Joe, do you have a moment you want to request that we listen to?
I'm trying to think because the CD's interspersed with dialogue, and I don't want to give too much of the show away. Why don't you do... following on almost immediately from where we're at, I like Fine White Horse, which is her first morning there. And she meets one of the maids who she immediately mistakes for her servant and says, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I've been told there's nothing to do here and I'm supposed to be shut up in these two rooms. And Martha has some suggestions.
Ah, there we go. Okay, another moment from Secret
Garden. Get your new clothes on, lass, and run out and play. That'll give your stomach for your porridge.
But what will I have to do? Mrs. Medlock told me there's nothing out there but a big old park.
If I had a fine white horse, I'd take you for a ride today. But since I have no fine white horse inside, I'll have to stay and empty all the chamber pots and scrub the floors and such. But what's there to do on a fine white horse? It seems to me not much. If I had a wooden boat, I'd take you for a sail today. But since I have no wooden boat inside, I'll have to stay and catch and kill the mice and pluck the chickens for the cook. But what's there to do on a wooden boat? But sit up straight and look, and worry our boat will start to drift and float us out to sea, and land us on an isle of gold. Oh dearie me. If I had a chambermaid, I'd take you out to play today. They say that there's a maze where once you enter, there you stay. For certain we'd get lost, and they'd come looking for our bones, and find us sometime late next week, and bring us tea and scones. But what if there's a clan of trolls a-camping beneath a tree? Oh, what if there's a pirate king? Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, dear. I'd take you out the door today. The talking birds and tales of fairies keep me scared away. And yes, I promised not to tell. What else is there, although? If in the maze you chance to see a garden guarded by a tree and meet a bird who speaks to me, then come and tell.
Yourself, then. It's down the stairs, past the ballroom, through the old...
I'll find it.
And, of course, what she's ultimately going to find, of course, is a garden, right? And a garden that has sort of a strange mystical connection to the departed Lily. And that is one of the keys to everybody finding their way back to joy. Kate, can you say a word about the challenge of bringing something like that to life on the stage, on the theatrical stage?
It's definitely hard because we really didn't want to have essentially a rolling set piece to roll the garden on and off. So we do have this beautifully done, you know, garden on the stage that I unfortunately cannot claim credit for painting at all because I'm not very good at it, and I had a couple of the cast members who did a great job at that, and it's definitely because it is mentioned quite frequently before Mary actually does find it that there is a garden there and that she does go outside and she's actually able to play outside because she's not able to do that in India. And so it was definitely, that was probably the hardest part, is figuring out how to stage the show. And both myself and our set designer, Ed Skinner, kind of scoured the internet for how did other people do this? Because we do have the constriction, of course, the smaller stage.
Right.
And making sure that it is kind of easily accessible to those who need to use it. So, but I think we came up with a really good, if I can say that, a really great set that I think is very versatile in the fact that you do have to reference the fact that you're in the house and out of the house and that Mary does remember parts of India. So obviously we can't have like a nice rotating set or a huge set like they did on Broadway.
Right, right. But yeah, that's part of the fun of community theater is figuring out a way to make this work to the very best of your ability. My recollection is that there's kind of a strange chorus in the Secret Garden, kind of a chorus of is it, are they like ghosts?
Yeah, it's all the people that Mary remembers from India. They call them dreamers. So it's her mother and her father and her servants and friends of her parents. And it's these people who are essentially kind of haunting her memory and trying to lead her to the garden and lead her to happiness. It's also Lily, of course, who's really has a hand in that and also trying to help Archie deal with his grief still. So it is. It's interesting because it's essentially a chorus of dead people.
Wow. Interesting. So how big a cast are we talking about?
There are 19 people in the cast. Oh. So it's a fairly big cast. I think it's the second biggest cast I've ever worked with all adults.
Right. Wow.
So, yeah, it was a challenge finding that many people, but I got extremely fortunate that I was able to find amazing cast members.
Hmm. Evelyn, just say a word about the importance of chemistry when it comes to those characters in the show with which you have to really interact and have particular relationships. I mean, like the frosty relationship with your uncle that eventually thaws, and the relationship with Colin, is he bedridden in your production?
Yes.
Yeah, so kind of the invalid little boy. Again, your relationship right off the bat does not begin very well, and then so on. And, of course, the relationship with the gardener that helps you find the garden. Just say a word about what is involved in making those relationships feel real.
Definitely doing the rehearsal process with everybody and kind of going through the same thing helps a lot. And Mary definitely has some of the first confrontations aren't the best with some of the characters. I mean, everybody gets along very well. So it's once Mary starts being, I guess, nice to people, it's very easy because I get along with everybody. Everybody's really nice. But then at the same time, it's almost fun and easy to get kind of bratty at them too, because I'm not normally like that to them.
Right,
so,
yeah, right. It's like this. There's this sense of liberation, I suppose. You can let out every dark corner of your soul a little bit, and then you get to put it away, and you become nicer, Mary over the course of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe, talk for a moment about the transformation of Archibald Craven and the process by which he eventually steps out of his grief. What has it been like to experience that kind of transformation?
It occurs fairly late in the show, there's brief little moments or two prior to that, but for the most part, he's pretty morose through most of it, some of that I'm trying to do with what I hope is subtle but noticeable physicality, a little hunched. He is supposed to be a hunchback, but we're not sort of going overboard with that. Moving fairly slowly most of the time, sort of deliberately and yet without purpose, if that makes sense. So it is sort of nice. It's nice to be able to come in for the last bit of the show, sort of letting some of that go and moving a little quicker. And as Katie pointed out, smiling for the first time in the show, you know, and it's sort of echoing what's been said. It has been really nice. It's a wonderful cast. I think there's great chemistry with everybody. My role is in some ways limited. I really interact with only three people up until the very end of the show.
Hmm.
But it's been very nice. I think I have a good chemistry with all three of them. It's wonderful. The two scenes that I get to share with Evelyn before the finale. I do a lot of my work with Matt.
Hoy,
thank you. I was going to put an N in there, and I knew that was wrong. who I think you've worked with playing my brother, who was also the doctor taking care of Colin, and so most of my scenes are with him. I think he and I have a very natural, I hope, familial chemistry on stage. And then I get to obviously share the stage with the woman playing Lily a couple times and dance in a quasi-terrified manner, because that's how I dance. So that's very natural. It's nice to make that transformation, and it's helped by the fact that it really occurs through music. And, you know, I've always told people I absolutely consider myself a singer who does a little bit of acting as opposed to an actor who sings. And so there's a wonderful sequence toward the end of the show in which I have a song and Lily has a song, and then we sort of come together for the tail end of it. And it really is just about that moment of letting go of the grief, letting go of the anger, literally forgiving her for leaving, and then being able to move on from that point.
Hmm. So, Kate, do you feel like you are ready to open? We're speaking the morning of opening night. I feel bad we got you out of bed after what I assume was a fairly lengthy dress rehearsal last night.
We actually didn't rehearse last night.
Oh.
So I'm kind of a firm believer, and this probably goes back to my father, not rehearsing the night before.
It is the only theater group I've ever worked with that doesn't do a final dress rehearsal the night before. So, but it's nice to have that night off.
Yeah, especially with a musical, because I really want them to rest. We've been rehearsing since Sunday, and especially with Evelyn and Lily, I think it's just nice to have that vocal rest, so they come in fresh today.
And she's nodding. She must agree.
Yeah. I think that we're ready. I was really confident Tech Sunday. We had what has probably been the easiest Tech Sunday I've ever been a part of, which is more contributed to the fact that I have extremely capable and great tech people than myself. So it was it's definitely, I was ready. So I was there last night, but that's just because I practically live there at this point. Right. So.
Wow. Well, we're glad to hear that everything is in such good shape for what promises to be some memorable performances of this beautiful musical, we should say, the song and lyrics by Marcia Norman and the music by Lucy Simon of the musical The Secret Garden. So it opens tonight, runs 3 weekends. What do people do if they want tickets?
You can go on roadiecenter.org to find tickets. We will obviously have tickets prior to the show. And I believe that all of the information is on there about the show. So I would definitely recommend getting tickets early. It is general seating, so come early. We do have a great concession stand with amazing popcorn. And, I think it's going to be a great show.
Very good. Katie Gray is the stage director for The Secret Garden. Evelyn
Alumbreros.
Alumbreros is in the role of Mary, and Joe Cardamone is in the role of Archibald Craven. Great to have all three of you here, and we wish you a very successful run of performances of The Secret Garden.
Thank you.
Let's go out with what's probably the best-known music from this musical, the wonderful song that that Joe will be participating in, the beautiful duet called Lily's Eyes.
Strangely quiet, but now the storm simply rests to strike again. Standing, waiting.
remains, she lingers on. Something stirs me to think of her. I think of her.
From death she casts her spell. All night we hear her sighs, and now a girl has come who has her eyes. She has her eyes. The girl has Lily's hazel eyes, those eyes that saw him happy long ago, those eyes that gave him life and hope he'd never known. How can he see the girl and miss those hazels?
She has her eyes.
The time is 8:46. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. We talk today about remaining young, and the topic is of great importance to just about all of us in various ways. And it is explored in most intriguing fashion in a brand new book called You, Staying Young, the Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. The book is co-authored by two doctors, Mehmet C. Oz, Dr. Oz, who is well known for his work on television, and one of his friends and colleagues, my morning show guest today, Dr. Michael F. Roizen, who is a best-selling author and co-founder of a popular website called RealAge.com. He is Chief Wellness Officer and Chair of the Wellness Institute of the Cleveland Clinic, and he is the Chief Medical Consultant to the Dr. Oz Show. And this book, published by Simon & Schuster, is just the latest in several collaborations between these two well-known and highly regarded doctors. Again, this newest book called You, Staying Young, the Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Dr. Michael Roizen, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you very much.
I'm excited to talk with you. And
Greg, the excitement is mine, so thank you.
The book really sets this whole topic in very healthy context, I think. That is, it's a good way for us to be thinking about this, and it brings into question some of the assumptions which a lot of us make. And one of them is this, that living longer is not the point. And, of course, you very carefully titled the book Staying Young. But at one point in the introduction, you say living longer should not be about taking longer to die. It should be about enjoying every moment of a longer life and taking longer to live. Obviously, that's a distinction that is very, very important to you and your co-author.
That's exactly right. The point of this is, if you will, the idea behind it is that you can live vibrantly till real near the end and then essentially get struck by lightning and die. And that's what most of us want to do, that is to live vibrantly and without frailty. And that's really a key. So if we eliminated all heart disease and all cancer, we might live 8 years longer. But if we eliminated frailty, you'd live 60 or 70 years longer. And that's and with vibrancy. And that's really the key, is how do you eliminate that frailty, and what do you do, and how easy is it to do it? So there are a lot of what we do, I mean, where there's science in the book, there's also a lot of action steps so people can understand both the science and then know what to do, and it's pretty easy things, what to do to change your rate of aging so that you stay vibrant. Now, one of the key points in science is you develop defects in yourself, in your cells, threefold greater every 10 years. So if you decrease your rate of aging by 10 years, you're essentially got threefold less defects in your cells. If you do it by 20 years, you got tenfold, three times three, so you get ninefold less errors. And so the key is slowing aging just by 20 years means that you are much more vibrant, much less likely to be frail as you do get older in calendar years.
One of the most surprising moments in the book, I think, but also a moment which is potentially of great help in helping us think about this in a sense more holistically is when you and Dr. Oz liken the human body to a city. Why is it helpful for us to think about our human body, our own body, and our sort of own personal physical health as something like a city? In what way is that model helpful and beneficial?
Well, the analogy lets people understand what it is. So you're, and let me give you some of the ideas. So a city can become old. Some of the European cities have become old and inelegant, whereas some cities that are old rejuvenate themselves, repair themselves, redesign themselves, such as Paris, and it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. And the analogy works in another way. San Francisco is built on earthquake faults. That's its genes, if you will. But whether it has a crisis for every sixth earthquake or not depends on what the citizens have done, what the regulations are, how they've treated their city so that it doesn't have every piece of building falls apart. They've learned how to build with architecture that can withstand sixes and maybe even sevens and maybe even eights of earthquakes. So the geography is your genes, but you get to change them. You get to know whether they will be affected or not by the way you act, by the way you make choices that influence your genes.
Hmm. That's a really fascinating insight which you offer, that because I think most of us think of our genetic makeup and our genetic predisposition as something entirely out of our own control. But you contend that there are actually steps that people can take, and probably as medical science continues to advance, there's going to be more and more which we can even do about our own health, even at that level of genetic predisposition, which is really an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, the real key, you know, probably the most important study that has been done since 2000, since we were able to characterize that we have a genome and what it is one that you get to take action steps for and that we talk about in the book, which is the ENCODE study. And you don't have to remember the name at all. But what we know is that about 10 to 20% of your total DNA is genes. And so what people thought the other 80 to 90% was junk. They called it junk DNA. But it isn't junk. It switches, and that's what the ENCODE study group found. It is switches that control your genes. So all your genes do is they're protein factories. But whether that factory is on or not is controlled by these switches. And it turns out your actions and your choices to a huge degree control those 22 to 30,000 genes by either turning them on or off. And let me give you a specific example. When you are stressed, you turn on 548, we know the exact number. You make them active producing proteins when you're stressed, genes that produce things that cause inflammation in your body. So there are 548 different proteins that are released when you get stressed. But if you manage that response so you aren't stressed, so the same event occurs, but now you have managed it so you don't get a stress response to it, none of those genes turns on. So you don't have the inflammation in your body. So you get to control, you literally get to control what's going on in your body.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Roizen, and we are talking about the book which he has co-authored with Dr. Mehmet Oz, You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Before we get into a few of the specifics in terms of how this book is put together, I certainly want you to have a chance to talk through the principles of longevity, which are part of the introduction, which I think are so helpful for anybody who wants to kind of think about the whole notion of what well-being is all about and what a long life at its best really entails. Explain, first of all, about how the process of aging, which of course is in an inevitable process, is involved in a whole lot of trade-offs. And what kind of good trade-offs do we need to be prepared to make?
Well, so we think of, if you will, aging as, if you will, creaky joints and constipation and bowels that don't work, et cetera. And you live to 80-something, and then in exchange you're going to have your fair share of misery. Well, that isn't the right trade-off. The right trade-off is, in fact, the reason that we get to over 30 and then develop problems is all our genes care about is that we reproduce. And we reproduce usually and largely and have for all of our history before the age of 30. So what makes sense for reproduction doesn't necessarily make sense for longevity. So, for example, when you go in a famine, you shut down your reproductive cells so that you don't produce a child during a time when they couldn't get the right nourishment. Makes total sense for this. You're shutting down processes. But when you go in a famine and you're old, as we talked about with calorie restriction, you in fact get to kill cells that are not going to survive. And when you're doing the refeeding, you actually produce more stem cells that then can repair damage. So the trade-off, what doesn't make sense for reproduction makes perfect sense for old age and vice versa.
Hmm.
And so those are the trade-offs that we talk about. Aging isn't some master plan for your life, but rather an offshoot of perpetuation of the species.
Michael Roizen is the author of this really intriguing book called You Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Next week on The Morning Show, we talk to Sarah Van Gelder, author of The Revolution Where You Live. On Tuesday, Art Sear offering his analysis of current events. Wednesday, Andrew Sperling, who is with the National Office of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. He's coming to Kenosha to speak next week. Thursday, we'll introduce you to the commanding officer of the Great Lakes Naval Base. A week from today, Joshua Moore's powerful memoir about addiction. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our normal programming is preempted for the rest of the morning because of NPR's coverage of the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump.